Being 8 o'clock and we've called the meeting to order, we do have a quorum. Representative Long, have you read the minutes, had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, and I move them.
Representative Long moves the approval of the minutes from January 30th, 2019. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. With that, the meeting today, we're going to have an overview of the four public employee retirement systems, and I believe they're going to do it as a group, so if you can come to the microphones. And I just ask whoever's speaking, if you'd lean into the microphone so that we can hear you. We've had some issues with volume down here, so, but welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself as you speak for the tape and proceed with your testimony. And if you want to move that chair up, the lever on the side, these chairs do go up. Yeah.
Good morning. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement Association.
I'm Erin Leonard, the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
I'm Jay Stoffel, the Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association.
Jill Schertz, Executive Director of St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association.
Well, welcome to the committee and listen to your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're very pleased to be here, and we do work a lot together collaboratively as we have over the last few years, and we're pleased to be here together to talk a little bit about the success of the bill from last year, the pension bill, and also to give you an overview of where each of the plans stands. So you'll hear from each of us. On page 2 is a summary of what we'll talk about today. With the pension bill, we'll get into why there was a need to take some action for our plans. We'll talk about the summary of the reforms, the changes in benefits and contributions, and then we'll talk about the impact of those changes, and also the role of the legislature and the various funds and their involvement with that process last year. And then each of us then will respectively talk about the different plans that our systems administer. That's the plan for today, and we appreciate you all braving the elements to hear our story. So we'll start with the why on the legislation. This went back actually about 3 or 4 years. And what these plans have in common is many features, but primarily they're based on pooled investments, professionally managed by the State Board of Investment, and St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association as well, and providing lifetime benefits to the members, as well as death benefits, disability benefits, and termination benefits. So these are long-term programs. They have a long-time expected horizon, even for just looking at current members who can be as young as age 20 or so, with the possibility of living well into their hundreds. We're looking at a 100-year time frame for these plans. So it's a long-term forecast, and a lot of benefits to be paid over that period of time. And we have to put a value on that. So there's a lot of assumptions that go into these plans, demographic assumptions and economic assumptions. And some of them are very easy to measure. The actuaries can look back and see the experience of the plan. They do experience studies. These are usually a 4 or 5 year look back period, and they say, well, what happened in the plan and how can we use that to predict what's going to happen in the future? And some assumptions are harder to forecast because it's all about the future. What will happen to mortality rates in the future? What will happen to investments in the future? So it's a combination of very objective work and subjective work. And the actuaries do a very good job for our funds. As one example of this is that I know with our fund, our largest fund, the General Employees Plan, the actuaries had predicted over a 4 year period that we'd see 4,471 males die, retirees. And actually it's 4,472. So they're only off by one. Very accurate. So the law of large numbers means they can be pretty accurate about looking backwards. Obviously they can't predict individual deaths with any kind of accuracy, but they're good at their work. But the forecast for the future can be different. And that's where the change came in. So back in 2014, the Society of Actuaries undertook a study nationally to try to better forecast rates of future mortality improvement. And it was that study, which they relied on data from the Center of Disease Control and the Social Security Administration, they talked to a lot of experts in various fields, it was that study that made some changes to what our actuaries recommended for the plan. So they had already built in some assumptions about mortality improvement, but this national study was more optimistic about what kind of improvements will happen in the future. And that national study said that we think people in the future are going to live 2 years longer than what was previously expected. So with that increase in expected lifetimes for retired members and current actives who are future retirees, that drives up the liabilities of the plan and means taking a fresh look. So that was a pretty significant change, and since that was applied to all plans as well as nationally, it had a pretty big impact overall. And the second big assumption is about future expectations of investment earnings. The fund had just come off two really good years. Fiscal year 17, there's a 15% return. Fiscal year 18 is a 10%, over 10% return. So those are good returns, but it's really the forecast about the future that drives that assumption. And the actuaries aren't necessarily experts on investments, so they look to investment consultants and get their opinion about what's the right expectation for the investments, allocations in this fund for the long-term future. They're looking at 20, 30, 40, 50 years out. And based on those forecasts from those experts came a recommendation from the actuaries to the funds to be more conservative. And so each of the funds supported changing the assumption return from 8% down to 7.5%. That was also supported by Governor Dayton as well as the Blue Ribbon panel. And so those are the two big driving forces behind the changes. So it wasn't so much about what had happened retrospectively. It's really the need for legislation was more about two significant changes to measure investments and mortality more conservatively in the future. And that's what led to some efforts to make some changes. I think Aaron will talk about those.
So the 2018 legislation included several different provisions that changed the plans. Some of them applied to all plans, and some of them were specific to each individual plan. So they were very individualized depending on the plan that they were covering. The changes that did apply to all plans included the reduction of the investment rate of return to 7.5%. Most of the plans were at 8%, so by making that change to 7.5%, that increased our liabilities immediately. They also did some benefit reforms to all plans. Eliminating future deferred augmentation, so individuals who left state service would accrue an inflation component after between the period in which they left public service and then the period in which they collected. That's been eliminated going forward for all members. We also increased the cost to retire early, so a lot of the reforms were around getting people to stay in the system, stay in public service, and if they choose to retire early, they're going to have to take a bigger reduction in their benefit to do so. And then the last change that applied to all plans was adopting a new amortization period. So when we plan for paying off our liabilities and collecting contributions to pay future benefits, we look at an amortization period, and this legislation reset all of our amortization periods to 30 years. So now everybody's on the same schedule. There are several things that this involved all active members, retired members, and deferred members. So all of these reforms did affect all plan members in some way. There were increases to employee and employer contributions for the MSRS General Plan, Correctional Plan, State Patrol Plan, PERA, Police and Fire, TRA, and St. Paul Teachers. Most of these contributions are phased in over a 2 to 4 year period, sometimes 5 depending on the plan. But all employees and employers had an increase for those plans. One note for the teachers and St. Paul Teachers Fund, the E-12 formula was will include the appropriations to fund these for school districts, so they won't have to cover that cost themselves. And then the appropriation or the contributions for the employer side for the other plans was also included in appropriations. So for state agencies, that'll be built into their agency budgets. And we'll talk a little bit more about the details as we go over each plan. For the correctional and state patrol plans, there was also an employer supplemental increase. And that contribution, that supplemental, will go away. It'll stop once the plans reach full funding or their 30-year amortization, whichever comes first. And then a few plans received direct appropriations. The PERI Police and Fire Plan received a direct appropriation each year, as well as St. Paul Teachers. For retirees, they have reduced COLAs in the future. So for the MSRS General, Correctional Teachers, and St. Paul Teachers, depending on the plan, there's a different variation of a COLA. In some cases, it's 1% for a period of time and then bumping up to 1.5%. In some cases, it's a fixed 1.5%. And then in some cases, in St. Paul's case, there's actually a COLA freeze for a few years before they actually see a contribution increase. So depending on the financial status of the plan, those retirees agreed to those COLA reductions to ensure that we had future sustainability of these plans. For PERA General and PERA Correctional, they actually modified their COLA structure to be more linked with inflation. So depending on the plan, they receive 50% of inflation with a floor and a cap. And then the other thing that affected COLAs were removing the COLA triggers. So back in 2010, there was legislation to reduce COLAs at that time. There was a trigger added, so if the funds reached a certain funding level, the COLAs would automatically increase. We actually removed those triggers as part of this legislation. And then for individuals who retire after 2024, they will receive a delayed COLA. So if they choose to retire early, they won't actually receive a cost of living adjustment in their retirement benefit until they reach full retirement age, which is in generally 65 or 66, depending on when they were hired. So if that's another cost to retire early, that's a decision they have to make and determine if they can fund that increased inflation in that period. And then Jay is going to talk a little bit about the impact of the legislation.
Good morning. So the 2018 pension bill was pretty remarkable in several ways. On page seven, there's a list of bullet points. First of all, it was a bill that had complete bipartisan support at every committee stop and on the floor of the House and the Senate. It received unanimous yes votes. So that was quite an accomplishment. It had broad support by a coalition of unions and employer and employee groups. Retiree organizations were on board, and all of that support was right on board right from the very beginning of the session. So it was a lot of cohesive work to get the bill passed. The financial part of this was also very remarkable. Over 30 years, the bill saved $6.1 billion. There was an immediate liability reduction of $3.4 billion the day the bill was signed. For every $1 that the state contributed towards the effort, there was a $3 effort put in by the retirees and the active members in terms of higher contribution rates to them or lower retirement benefits. So it was a very good deal for the state of Minnesota, and it was also a very good deal for the members of the plans. We have sustainable plans. It puts us on a very good trajectory as far as reaching full funding. That's very important for the members to understand, to know, and feel good about their pension, that it's solid. It'll be for them in the future. And we're talking about half a million Minnesotans that are either active or retired in these plans. So the bill had just great leadership on the Senate side. Senator Rosen was a real champion of the bill. Representative Tim O'Driscoll on the House side, both really great authors and great leaders to get the bill passed. The next page is a comparison of where we stand after the bill was passed and after a very good investment year. As Doug said, we had over a 10% return in fiscal year 18. So with those two things, the passage of the bill and a very good investment year, we are now in aggregate almost 82% funded. So that's simply a comparison of our assets to our liabilities. Pension nirvana is 100%. That's where we want to be. We have all the assets in the bank compared to our liabilities. But we're not there. We accomplished a lot last year to get us there, and we're moving in the right direction. But again, it's good to see that we're ahead of the national average. Around 74% is the average around the country. So we're in a good place relative to our peers. And it's not so much where we are, but it's always the direction that we're heading. You can look at a plan, any plan around the country, and you can look at their funding ratio, and that's just one side of the story. But the other real important side is, what direction are they moving? Are they going towards 100% funding? Are they heading south? And we are in a good place and heading north, so that's a good place to be. all the plans that were included in the bill from the state retirement system, the teachers' plans, and the public employee plans are now all on positive trajectories and expected to be fully funded within that 30-year time period. The next page, 9, also a noteworthy piece of information here. This got national attention, not only just from the media. There were a lot of good media reports, I think, some degree, because of the bill was voted unanimously on the floors. That got some attention. But out in New York, Wall Street was paying attention. They've been really taking a close look at pensions as they do their work, analyzing credit ratings of the states and the municipalities around the country. And pension obligations and pension liabilities are a very important piece of the equation. They've really been focused on that for the last, especially 5 years, I guess. Some very good comments right in their analysis and their reports. They mentioned the work of the Minnesota legislature to change, to make the changes that we did, and S&P increased the state's bond rating to AAA in part because of the pension story. There were some other factors as well, but pensions were specifically noted by S&P in getting the AAA rating for the state of Minnesota. Fitch had the state at AAA. Moody's, I think it's a notch below AAA, but again, very positive comments by the rating agencies. And that flows through to the municipalities and the school districts and so forth. So very good news on that front as well. So on page 10, we'll shift gears a little bit here. The second item on our agenda is talk about governance. And you should know that each of the four systems that are appearing before you today each have a board of either directors or trustees. So they administer the plan, have a staff. TRA, we've got a staff of about 95 people. But we do all the administration from receiving contributions, paying out benefits, keeping track of all the member data that we have and that we need to calculate benefits. And that's a very important function. We have a lot of sensitive data from name, address, birth date, bank account number, Social Security number. So we have a lot of very sensitive data. We take that very seriously. We have to protect the assets that we have. The money is important, but the data is a very, very important part of what we do, too. And keeping that safe and secure is a big part of what we do. We spend a lot of time on member service, educating our members about their pension. We do group presentations, a lot of individual counseling as people near retirement. Primarily, it seems on an individual basis, most people really start thinking about their pensions at about age 45 or 50, thereabouts. Before that, they're paying in, and they got all kinds of other things that they focus on. But we're doing a lot of work to try to capture their attention and get them to focus somewhat on pension, because it's important from the day they're hired until the day they retire. But a lot of member education in groups and individual basis. And then, of course, we do all the actuarial work every year. We measure the actuarial and the financial condition of the plan. We do a lot of extensive financial reporting. So all of that is a lot of scrutiny, lots of audits. We have the state auditor in our office, the legislative auditor in our office. We have internal audits. So a lot of good scrutiny. That's always important with the size of assets that we have and the sensitive data that we have. So that's the business of the board and the staff. But the bottom part of this slide is very important, too, and I think we want to kind of mention this and help you understand and make sure you understand that there's a lot of control by the legislature. So everything, all the plan provisions, everything in terms of the who's eligible to be in the various plans, that's determined by law. The contribution rates are set in law. The benefit formula is set in law. The investment return assumption, the investment guidelines. So a lot of direct control by the legislature and all of those things. So that's an important part of what we do and how we operate. So, and with that, we're going to turn our attention to an individual look or a look at individual plans. So I will MSRS is next.
So at MSRS, we administer five traditional defined benefit pension plans, and we also administer a few defined contribution plans that are available to public employees throughout the state. Our largest defined benefit plan is our general plan, And this is includes most state employees, Metropolitan Council employees, University of Minnesota, and some Minnesota State University System employees. We have benefited from the great return this year, and our market value funded ratio is actually 90.6%. So much improved from last year. We have $13.3 billion in assets and a $1.3 billion unfunded liability. So that means we have 90.6% of the funds in the bank to pay future benefits. In total, we have over 117,000 members, and those are broken down by active, retired, and deferred. Over almost 41,000 retired folks receive checks from us each month. And then individuals who retire within the system, when they first retire, the average initial benefit is about $1,700 a month. So a comfortable benefit, but nothing. Sometimes you hear of these exorbitant benefits throughout the country. Ours are fairly modest relative to others. For the contribution rates, so currently, and part of the legislation, phased in contribution increases for employees and employers. So the employee contribution rate, when fully phased in, will be 6% of pay. So employees actually do contribute to their individual pensions and will be contributing 6% of pay into the future. The employer contribution is phasing up to 6.25% of pay. And this is the first time that this plan has seen a difference in the employee and employer contribution rates. They actually used to be the same throughout history. When we drafted the legislation last year and everything was agreed upon, the state agreed to contribute a little bit more because those increased liabilities weren't necessarily the fault of active employees. The moving to 7.5% assumed rate of return, as well as the life expectancy, affected retirees as well. So they are going to pay slightly more than employees. As I mentioned, the additional state funding is included in the appropriations from last year and will be built into agency budgets as they prepare those budgets for this next biennium. Our total required contribution to pay future benefits is 11.1%. So that means we need to collect 11.1% today to pay future benefits for current active employees. And what that means, as you can see, once we fully phase contributions in, we'll be at 12.25%. So this is the first time that I've been able to say for several years that we'll have a contribution sufficiency once everything is phased in. So we'll have a slightly over 1% contribution sufficiency. I will note that all of our plans as we go through this do have a slight sufficiency, and some of them have a larger sufficiency than others. However, it's important to, this is a long-term business, and I think you all are aware of the current investment markets. And so what this really means in my mind is that we have a cushion to kind of we're braced a little bit for any sort of volatility we have in the market in the future. So sometimes folks want to immediately do things, but we're really looking at the long term and using caution when talking to our stakeholders about our contribution sufficiencies. Our second plan is the correctional plan, and this includes employees who work with offenders in the state correctional system or patients in the state security hospitals. So there is a requirement they must have 75% contact with offenders or patients in the hospitals to be qualified to be in this program. It is considered a public safety plan, so it does have an earlier retirement age. They have a full retirement at age 55 because of the nature of their work. Our fund is 74.8% funded. We have $1.1 billion in assets and a almost $376 million unfunded liability. There's about almost 10,100 members in this program and about 4,650 active members. So these are the individuals that are currently working in the facilities. Their average initial benefit is just over $2,000 a month. This does have a higher contribution rate because it is a public safety plan and they do have that earlier retirement. So once fully phased in, their employee contribution will be 9.6%. The employer contribution will be 14.4%. And then as I mentioned earlier, they do have a supplemental employer contribution of 4.45%. The total required contribution for this plan is just over 25%. And they will, once everything is phased in, have a sufficiency of 3.15%. Our state patrol plan includes our state troopers, conservation officers, BCA officers, and other peace officers employed by the state. This is a smaller plan, and it's an interesting plan in the sense that it has more of the liabilities on the retiree side than the active side, so you actually see more ups and downs each year for this plan. 78.4% is the funded ratio. There's a $729 million in assets, a $200 million unfunded liability, and 921 active members of our 2,000 members. So you can see that those retired numbers are higher than the active. Their average initial benefit is $3,970. You might say that's really high. However, they aren't coordinated with Social Security. So that means that this is their only retirement benefit. They don't have Social Security. They're not contributing as an active member. So this is their only benefit. Employees are going to contribute 15.4, employers 23.1. The supplemental employer contribution is 7% in this plan once fully phased in. That sounds like a lot, but it's really about $6 million because it's such a small plan. And they also receive a $1 million annual appropriation that was included in the 2010 legislation. So they do have a total required contribution of 40.2%, and they will have a sufficiency of 5.3 once everything is phased in. Although keep in mind that because of the high retiree liability, there's a lot more volatility with this plan, so that sufficiency can be eroded fairly quickly. And these are our funding projections. So Jay mentioned that we don't want to just look at today's numbers. We don't want to just look at the funded ratio as of June 30th. We also have to look at where we're heading in the future. And so these are our three plans, General Correctional and State Patrol. The solid line is if we wouldn't have passed legislation and would have just had a 10.3% return this year, that's where our projections would look. So last year they were heading downward. This year they were somewhat flat if we wouldn't have had the pension reforms. The great thing about the pension reforms is now we are actually heading to 100% or over 100% in all those plans within the 30-year period. So just by making those shifts and having that great return, we're on a much better path for the future. The other plan that we administer is our judges plan, and this plan was not included in the legislation last year. This plan had gone through some pretty significant reforms in 2013 and wasn't included in the legislation. It includes judges, appointed or elected, and they it has a 53.4% funded ratio, and you might say, well, that seems a lot lower than everybody else, and it is. But the reason for that is it was not pre-funded until 1992. So all of these other plans that have been in existence, we started paying those pre-funded contributions, paying what we need to collect today for future benefits far before that in the 70s or 60s. This plan didn't start that process until 1992, so they've kind of been playing catch-up for quite some time. They have $200 million in assets and $176 million in unfunded. There's 317 active judges, and their average initial benefit is $5,663 a month. This group is interesting because they start later, and so but they don't have full retirement until 65 or 66, so there's a shorter period in which for us to pre-fund those benefits in the future. The employee and employer contribution varies depending on when they were elected or appointed. If they're elected or appointed before 2013, it's 9%. If they're elected after that, it's 7%, and that's because they have a lower benefit structure going forward. So any new judges are in a lower benefit structure. The employer contributes 22.5%, and then as part of that 2013 legislation, the plan receives $6 million annual appropriation. And they do have a slight sufficiency, so 0.1% is their sufficiency. The projections for this plan are a little interesting. Doug, my actuary colleague, was wondering why it was like this. So last year, they actually looked better funded, and they were heading to 100% within their amortization period, and that's the solid line. This plan, although it didn't have any part of the benefit reforms, it actually did decrease the assumed rate of return. So this is what you can actually see the increase of liabilities and the impact on the plan if you don't have other things to go along with it, and that's the dotted line. So this is the only plan right now that is not expected to be 100% funded within the 30-year period. It is projected to reach 100%. It's just about 5 to 8 years later. So kind of an interesting exercise if you're into actuarial math. The other plan that we administer is the legislator's plan. This is a plan that was closed in 1997. You will likely see an appropriation for this plan to pay benefits. So it's a pay-as-you-go model for the retired members of the legislature that are in this program. And then just for your information, we do administer the unclassified plan, which is the plan that you are participating in and legislative staffers participate in, agency heads, commissioners. We have about 3,200 members in that program. We administer the deferred compensation plan, which is a voluntary program It's a 457B plan, similar to a 401K that's available to all public employees in the state. It's the fifth largest in the country. $7 billion is our assets. And then we have our healthcare savings plan, which is also available to all public employees in Minnesota. We have over 122,000 members, $1.1 billion. And this is something where employees can save funds to pay for future healthcare expenses after they leave public service. So it's a tax-preferred status, and they can save for the future.
Yeah, I'll talk about the PARA plans next. So I'll start with the general plan. This is our largest plan in the state by number of members, not by assets. And it includes eligible employees of cities, counties, townships, schools. Think of all the people in the schools who aren't teachers. They're mostly in this plan. And it's roughly half of them are the municipal employees, half are employees of schools. So it's a very large number by the number of members. We have over 150,000 active members. We now have over 100,000 retirees in the plan. And this is the one plan where I would look at the average benefit is $1,275 a month, but the median to me is a little bit more interesting that it's quite a bit different. So the median average benefit is $870 a month. So half of the members in this plan receive $870 a month or less. The funding comes from the employees, 6.5%, and the employer, 7.5%. The Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund merged into the plan back around 2010, and then it was fully merged in 2015. That means it shared all the investment risk and impact at that time. There's a total contribution of $37 million through the year 2031, which is currently allocated $31 million to the city of Minneapolis and the state picking up $6 million. So there is currently a contribution sufficiency of 1.52% over and above what the actuary recommends is needed to fully fund the plan in 30 years. That's why this plan is on track to be fully funded by the year 2037. So about a 1% increase. So 79.5% funded currently should increase by about 1% a year going forward. And we know it's going to be a bumpy road, but that's the projected path going forward. For the police and fire plan, this is, again, the police and fire for the cities and counties and townships. This plan is 88.8% funded with $8.5 billion in assets and a $1.1 billion unfunded liability. About 11,600 active members, 10,700 retirees. So it's about a one-to-one ratio of actives to retirees. So it's a very mature plan. Aaron mentioned this as well, that a plan that has that kind of ratio of actives to retirees can be a little more sensitive on the funding. So anything that affects the liability, when you're ultimately translating that into a cost as a percent of payroll, it means the plan can be a little bit more sensitive to any kind of changes or market fluctuations. Average benefit here is $4,895, and also, as Aaron mentioned, these members do not participate in Social Security. So the contributions to the plan, it's 11.8% from the employees, 17.7% from the employers. I have a lot of asterisks on this one to cover. Those reflect the changes in the recent bill. These show the fully phased in amounts from the employee and the employers. So it's a 1% increase from the employees, 1.5% from the employer. So that's the fully phased in amount. Here, too, there was some mergers with the Minneapolis Police Relief Association and the Minneapolis Fire Relief Association, and these amounts are actually subject to recalculation. So there's a commitment to pay the unfunded portion. These commitments are paid through the year 2031. The amounts shown here are the current amounts, but whenever the investment return assumption changes, the statutes say that there needs to be a recalculation of that amount. So that's currently in process, and those amounts may change. And then there's state contributions really coming in two components, one that had been existing before the recent pension bill of $9 million a year until both the MSRS Highway Patrol plan and this plan is 90% funded. The new change added another $9 million a year, currently being phased in. So that asterisk is noting that when those are fully phased in, it's $18 million a year, which is about 1.8% of payroll. So the sufficiency looks kind of large, but that's counting in all a fully phased in amount as well as some contributions that will be going away either at a fixed time period or when a plan reaches fully funded. So that's kind of the maximum sufficiency. But it does put this plan also on a path to improve by about 1% a year and an expected full funding date of 2031. And our correctional plan, this one's easier, and it's in a really relatively nice position. At 97.6% funded, there's $680 million of assets, a relatively small unfunded liability. There are currently about 3,900 actives, only a little over 1,000 retirees. This is a relatively newer plan. It's only been around 20 years, so it doesn't have that low ratio of actives to retirees. So it's kind of a growing plan. And the contribution structure is pretty simple. It's 5.83% from the employees, 8.75% from the employer, which is very close, just slightly over the required contribution. And that's why this plan, it's close to 100% funded, and it's not really expected to improve that rapidly because it doesn't need to improve that rapidly. It's expected to stay on a path of being close to 100% funded. And then that's shown on our funding projections, and just echoing, I think, what you've heard a couple times already, this, to me, is the most important thing to look at. It's just what direction are these plans going, and it shows where these plans were headed before the reforms and where they're headed after, and all of them on a path to be fully funded within 30 years if all assumptions are met. So those are the three biggest para plans. We also do administer the statewide volunteer firefighter plan, which currently has about 158, I believe, different participating fire departments covering over 4,000 members. This was established in 2010. It's been growing. It's approaching $90 million in assets. We also have a defined contribution plan, primarily for elected officials, 7,700 members, close to $70 million in assets. And then we administer a plan for other post-employment benefits, of which 23 different entities participate in that. This is to manage benefits different than pension benefits. And more recently, there's established a long-term investment account that if certain entities can meet qualifying conditions, they're allowed to invest in the State Board of Investment, and we strictly administer that plan. So there's two participants in there now with $3 million in assets.
Okay, we'll turn to the teacher plan, Teachers Retirement Association on page 23. So the CRA covers all public schools, K through 12, all charter schools, and some faculty at the Minnesota State institutions. Those faculty people have a choice to make when they're first hired to belong to either TRA or an IRAP plan. It's an IRA style kind of a program. And then they have another choice again at tenure time to make a choice. But for the most part, our membership is comprised of the public and charter schools, and we cover everybody in the state except for the good teachers in the city of St. Paul. So Jill will cover that next. The TRA is about 78% funded on a market value basis, $22 billion in assets. We have a $6 billion unfunded liability. Almost 200,000 members broken down between active, retired, and deferred. Deferred, by the way, are people who have contributed to the plan and are no longer contributing, and they're also not receiving a benefit. They're sort of in just on hold status. They may not be of age yet to receive a benefit. A person has to be at least age 55 to collect a benefit. So that's what we mean by the deferred members. Initial benefit in TRA is $2,175. Contributions and funding, the employee contribution rate, again, 7.75, that's the fully phased in. Our contribution rates phase in beginning in fiscal 19 and are fully phased in fiscal year 2023. So that's the fully phased-in contribution rate on the employee side. The employer side, 8.95%, and that's a little confusing, too. Today, the rate for the employer is 7.71, but the city of Minneapolis, because of the merger of the Minneapolis Teacher Pension Plan, pays an additional 3.64%. So the rate that I have here, the 8.95, is the blend of the 7.71 and the 3.64% from the city from the school district of Minneapolis. And then we also have a couple of people, actually literally two people, that are still remaining that are in what we call our basic plan. Those people are not covered by Social Security. There was a time when teachers in Minnesota were not covered by Social Security. So we call those people basic members. We have two left paying into the plan. And the rest of the folks are all covered by Social Security. We call those coordinated members. We get some additional state funding of 0.69%. So in total, the money coming into the plan is 17.39%. The required, the actuaries are telling us, the requirement is 17.18. So that leaves us with a sufficiency of 0.21% of payroll. I'll go on to the next page, page 24. And we get some direct state funding, and in our recent history, there have been a couple of mergers. On June 30, 2006, the Minneapolis Teacher Retirement Fund merged in with the Teachers Retirement Association. And that was a very long story. It's a complicated merger. They brought with them into our plan $1 billion of unfunded liability. So that's a big part of the discussion when there are any mergers of pension plans. You're typically merging somebody who's well-funded and someone who's not so well-funded. It's rare to have all of that match up very close. So the discussion is always what to do about that difference. So part of the deal was that the state would contribute almost $13 million a year until TRA is fully funded. So we get that from the state of Minnesota on an annual basis. Then there's another state match. The city of Minneapolis contributes $1.25 million, and the school district of Minneapolis puts in $1.25 million. That's matched by the state of Minnesota, $2.5 million. So that all of that is part of the matching component of the deal. And then on top of that, the city and the school district each put in another $1 million. So that's all part of the financing of the merger of the Minneapolis Employee Teachers Retirement Fund. And the cities, the city of Minneapolis and the school district of Minneapolis were part of that financing, because there was a time when those entities were the employer of record. It wasn't really the state of Minnesota that was controlling the, on the contribution side. So there was a long history of some underfunding in those days. So I'm talking about in the 50s and the 60s, maybe even back in the 30s and the 40s, there were some underfunding on the employer side. So they were partially on the hook for some of that unfunded liability that was existing at the time of the merger. So it was a multi-part solution to making that merger happen. Another merger happened June 30, 2015. The Duluth Teacher Retirement Fund merged with the TRA, and they had a little bit different story. They had a long history of the employer overfunding the pension plan, so they had a pretty good long history of being very well funded, overfunded, usually between 90 and 100% funded for most of their history. But what was happening in Duluth was a demographic shift. I kind of know this story because I lived there for 25 years. I actually ran the Duluth Teacher Pension Plan for 22 years. All the schools that my children attended are now gone, from Chester Park Elementary, Woodland Middle School, and Central High School. They don't exist anymore. The schools are closing. The city is not growing. Population sign stays the same for 25 years that I drove by it. It was 85,000 people. So the city ages, and in that respect, there's just not a growth in the number of students. So what we found in Duluth, or what occurred in Duluth, was a complete demographic shift. We ended up with twice as many retirees as active contributing members. And when the Great Recession hit, and there was a kind of a depletion of the assets, not entirely, but there was a large unfunded liability that existed, with only 800 people left and 1,500 people drawing benefits, it became an issue that needed some resolution, and so it seemed merger was the only solution to that issue. So $14,377,000 a year goes into the TRA for the Duluth merger. Another piece is the amortization state aid. That's something left over from the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund merger. That was an aid payment that they were receiving, something they had negotiated and gotten into legislation to help with their previous unfunded liability situation. So when the merger occurred, we inherited that amortization aid payment and continue to receive that today. So in total, per year, $31 million coming from the legislature, from the state to and state funding to the TRA. 26 is another story, and this is part of the 2018 pension bill. So as our employer contribution rates ramp up, they're increasing by 1.75%. So, and that's occurring over 6 years. So as those employer rates are increasing, the state is contributing to the school districts so they can afford the higher employer contribution rates. There have been some years, specifically in the 2010 legislation, when employer contribution rates were increased and there was no additional state funding for that, so the school districts had to deal with that in their budgets in whichever way they could. But in this legislation in 2018, there's state funding behind the higher increasing employer contribution rates. So what I'm showing you on the chart is that in fiscal 19, our contribution rate went from 7.5 to 7.71, and there was about a $9 million appropriation to the Department of Education for that employer contribution. So the Department of Education then, that gets distributed via a pension adjustment in the school aid formula. And that is all allocated to each school district based on covered payroll. So it's a very precise calculation. We know the percent increase on payroll, and we know the payroll of each school district. So that's the amount of the pension adjustment that they get. So it's a very precise calculation. It works very well. And you can see how over the next few years, fiscal 20 through 23, I'm not going to talk about fiscal 24 yet, so just for the next 4 years, I've got information from the Department of Education that they're going to be putting into the budget, and it shows that there will be $19.4 million in fiscal 20, $30.8 million in fiscal 21 that needs to be appropriated to the Department of Education so they can make those pension adjustments to the school districts. Fiscal 22 and 23 are there also their projections. Fiscal 24 is not their projection, but I put it on here because we know what the final piece of the increase will be on the employer contribution, but they're not budgeting anything. It's not part of their process. I just assumed a normal growth pattern looking at 22 and 23 and just built that into 24 just so you understand. That's my number. That's not the Department of Education number. So that's the additional financial commitment made by the state for the 2018 pension bill. On the next page is the condition of the TRA before and after the legislation and after a good investment year. And again, this just reflects the similar story that you've heard before. We were not on a good path. We weren't in such a horrible place at 70% funded, but the direction was not good. But now we are in a very good place. Our trajectory looks good. I think Doug mentioned it's not going to look anything like this. It's not going to be this smooth as we experience markets ups and downs. This is going to be a very jagged line. We're not going to try to draw that jagged line, but we hope to, that the end point it stays the same. It's just a matter of how we get there and what shape it takes. Again, the big news is really the direction that this line now has taken. And it was part of the national attention that we got that the legislature, the governor, really did a fabulous thing by getting these directions heading in the right direction, all these trajectories heading in the right direction. With that, we'll hear from our friends at St. Paul.
Good morning. As I mentioned, I'm Jill Schertz with the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. We represent about 12,000 teachers in principally the public school district of St. Paul. I just want to say I'm incredibly grateful for the bipartisan effort last year. It's fundamentally changed the trajectory of this plan and so many others. I also want to say I think after three cold days with three teenagers at home, I'm incredibly grateful for teachers and anxious for my children to go back to school tomorrow, I hope. I'm also grateful that they make me watch MacGyver episodes over and over again today as our gate was stuck and I had to do unspeakable things to get my car out of the driveway. So with that, why am I excited about being at 64% funded ratio? I think a lot of people might look at that and not be too pleased. The reality is that's a great number, and it speaks volumes for what the members of this plan did in partnership with the legislature. Had we not had the legislation last year, we would have expected this number to immediately drop to 57-58%. But worse than that, have a long-term trajectory you'll see on the next page down much lower and then just flatline. Obviously not a good outcome. But with this, we were able to secure funding. But also, as we've mentioned before, the compromise and the partnership with Minnesota is a number of very meaningful reforms to the plan. So we're grateful, in particular, our actives withstood meaningful compromises. And our retirees, in order to secure the direct funding and, more importantly, make sure that the actives didn't have a greater contribution increase. Our retirees, as was mentioned, actually took a two-year freeze. They were at 1% on their cost of living adjustment, and they have agreed to take 2 years at zero. For those of you that have been around pensions for a while, you know that's no easy thing. So we're very grateful for the effort that took. We have about $1.1 billion of assets. After taking on the increased mortality, the reduction in the investment return, we took on about another additional $100 million of liabilities, which puts us at 605 on the unfunded. Of our 12,000 members, you can see the split. We have a relatively recent new phenomenon where now we have slightly more retirees than actives. We're watching that very closely, and when you sort of do the SWOT analysis on your plan, I would say now that we've addressed the funding, that's the issue we watch most closely. I would say in the last probably 2 to 3 years, the biggest chunk of that change is due to a change of how substitute teachers are treated. They're no longer treated as active members. That's become an independent contractor relationship. As well, you've probably read, the district is undergoing substantial issues over the last few years. They have a new superintendent in place. They are actively addressing enrollment. And for this year, we saw a modest increase for the first time in the last several in our number of active teachers. So again, I would say the trend is in a positive direction, but we watch it closely. As Doug mentioned earlier, Blanket's executive director, I like to think this is a very mature plan. So we have, as you look at the distribution of our retirees, we have a very large number of our retirees 80 years or older. So as we look at that, it's reasonable to expect that over the next few years, we could also see the number of retirees change as well. Like the others, there's a relatively modest benefit, especially when you consider the after-tax basis of about $1,700. When we look at the contribution and funding requirements section, when the changes are fully phased in, we go to $775. That represents a 0.25% increase for our actives. Again, a question we've received is, why is the employer contributing more than actives? In the case of St. Paul, it's a little unique. For several decades, there was a disparity. The employees were actually paying more than the employer. So this was a compromise meant to allow the employer to catch up to historical underfunding. On the employer side, over a six-year period, you'll see on the next page, our employer contribution ramps up to 9%. As well, St. Paul, for a period of time, has been paying a supplemental, and that's based on historic underfunding. There was a point in time several decades ago where that additional amount was agreed upon. In total, St. Paul, through four legislative actions over the last two decades, receives about $15.7 million in direct funding. $5 million of that came with the legislation last year, and again, that largely represents the agreement of our retirees to go with a two-year COLA freeze. Contribution sufficiency right now, 2.75%. I know when some people look at that, they may wonder, did we overshoot the mark on funding? And I would say absolutely not. In fact, it's actually, I think, something most plans should strive for. It allows you to withstand the variations in the market and other actions. As well, one of the changes in the 2018 legislation was actually that all of this additional supplemental funding falls off when this and other plans reach 100%. So even if we get to 100% earlier than we were projected to, the funding drops off. So again, if you see sufficiencies in that plan, I think they should be applauded. As we look at the next page on the upper left-hand side, you can see how the funding paces in over the six-year period. Through FY 2024, the 0.25% employee and the additional direct state allocation. It's that upper left-hand box that allows us to go from the 64% dot all the way up to, as of today, projected to be 107%. The 102% line is what we have projected when the legislation was actually enacted. The red line, of course, is where we'd end up had we not had the legislation. So again, we're very grateful for the way this has turned out. I'd also say on a national level, as we look at this Minnesota experience and this bipartisan effort, it stands in stark contrast to what we saw last year across the country. It was in many plans, as well as if you look at some of the multi-employer pension plans like the Teamsters, which I saw for the first time across our country where retirees took cuts in their actual benefit payments because of severe underfunding. We saw teachers in many states go on strike, and that continues to this year as well. Over six or seven states are facing that. And there are several states that really face constitutional crises involving their pension plan. But that's not the case here, and I think we're very proud of that from our plan's perspective and for Minnesota. So with that, I'll stop.
Well, thank you. And I have a couple of questions. Some of these are to get information or get education to our members here. One is you talked about coordinated people not having Social Security, and why is that, that they don't have Social Security is one of those questions, and what do you mean by coordinated so that people can understand that? Because that's a term that gets thrown around, coordinated, non-coordinated, basic plans. So, Mr. Stoffel, you touched on it earlier. But
yes, Mr. Chairman, so the terminology coordinated simply means that those are the members that are paying into Social Security as well as the Minnesota Public Pension Plan in which they belong. The basic members only have Social Security coverage no public employee pension plan coverage. And there was a time in Minnesota when all the teachers were basic. They weren't covered by the pension plans. There was pension plan coverage, but it was a different formula. So
I thought you got that backwards.
I misspoke on that. But so there's always been pension plan coverage. We've been in existence since 1931, but there was a different formula. They were paying. So with the basic members not having Social Security coverage, they have a higher employee contribution rate. They have a higher pension formula, but it's essentially similar to what Aaron was talking about with the state patrol and Doug with the police and fire. That's all they have. So I think there was a time in the 80s where choices were made and elections were made and people became coordinated with them with Social Security.
And some of those police and fire plans predate Social Security, which is why they were started. Again, I wanted to get that out there for people to know. The other question I had, Ms. Schertz touched on about how our funds are doing in the state of Minnesota compared to other funds that we hear about around the country, so I don't need to ask about that one. The one thing I noted, too, with the judges' plan, they would have a higher benefit, and I'm assuming that's because they have higher wages, and so the plans are all based on what the employees make when they are making when they retire. Am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. But that is the average initial benefit. So those are the judges that were elected or appointed prior to 2013. So they have a higher benefit formula as well as higher wages. So their formula times their years of service plus their higher wages creates that higher benefit. Any judges elected or appointed after 2013 have a lower benefit formula, so we would expect those average initial benefits to go down.
But with a higher wage, they're going to have the benefit will skew a little bit higher.
Correct, yes.
No matter what the formula is.
There's also, it's fairly difficult, as I've talked to judges, it's fairly difficult for them to recruit judges because they have their earning potential in the private sector is generally greater than they receive for compensation as a judge. So the pension is a really big motivator for some of those individuals taking those positions, which is a little unique relative to our other plans because it's such a specialized area.
And they get the last question I've got here. Now the pension, the budget year for the pension, when does that end, and how are we? I believe that's June 30th. Is when the budget year is. How are we doing now in the last 6 months with the market up and down with the investment returns? Do we know or?
I'll start. Mr. Chair, members, we do all of our measurements and all of the reporting that we've given you as of our end of fiscal year, which is June 30th, 2018. At that point, our rate of return for the year was 10.3%. I think we're all aware that the last 6 months have not been the same. We are in negative territory right now for a rate of return from State Board of Investment, although we do have some time before the end of the until we measure again on June 30th of 2019. So we don't know the exact funded ratio and everything because we only do measure that at one point in time each year.
That answers my question. Thank you. I have a question from Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and like you, I've got a few questions, so I hope we have time. Thank you for the presentation. I'm one of those individuals that believes that a promise made is a promise kept and that we need to do whatever is necessary to ensure the integrity of these plans. That said, I'm wondering a little bit if you could comment about the population pyramid, the distribution of the members of the plan and how we, as many of us in this room as baby boomers, have had impacts all through our lives in terms of stress on the system. And I noticed that you made some comments with regard to when the plans will kind of be on track, and that's some 25, 30 years out. And I think that reflects where baby boomers are today and entering retirement, that at some point in time, maybe the distribution or the population distribution within the plans is more equal, and you won't have so many people on retirement. Could you comment about that?
Whoever wants to.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas. Yes, that's a good question. That kind of falls into the work that we benefit from the actuaries that they do. They do a lot of work to project every single member in the plan. They're doing projections on what they expect from that member, how long they'll be active, when they may retire, how long they'll survive. So we do know that there is the baby boom generation that's moving towards retirement. They do capture that movement and see how that will transition and from the active group getting a little bit smaller, the retiree group getting a little bit larger typically. We do pay close attention to that. And it is fairly common to know that because these are very mature plans, that's kind of the natural course of these pension plans, is to anticipate that these are mature plans, that there will be periods of time in which contributions coming in from active members may be less than the benefits going out. But that's why it's so important that these plans are pre-funded, too, so that we have plans that are 100% or striving to be 100% funded, and we can rely on those investment earnings to manage through that process. We do try to capture all the information about those expected changes.
And a blurb I heard on the radio the other day was that sometime this next year or this year, millennials will be a larger part of the U.S. population than baby boomers. So we're going away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I have been a trustee on a private pension plan, and for more than a decade having to deal with and grip with some of the responsibilities there. And oftentimes it's incumbent to compare a private sector plan with those in the public sector. And with regard to the unfunded pension liabilities, I've been aware for some time that it's a rather nebulous number. It seems like state taxpayers are on the hook for anywhere from 19 to $30 billion of unfunded pension liabilities. And I noted in your presentation with the pension bill, you commented that about $6 billion improvement in that unfunded liability. Kind of just flipping through the slides, I kind of did a quick tally, and it looks like, on at least in your presentation, you're showing around 15 or 16 billion of total unfunded liabilities. Is this, the presentation you did, is this representative of all of the plans in Minnesota in which taxpayers, Minnesota state taxpayers, are on the hook for, or are there a few other plans out there that affect that number? And what, in your opinion, is that unfunded liability in total right now?
Whoever?
Well, I can speak for teacher plans. The two of us on this end of the table, all Mr. Chair and Representative Kurtoff, we are in total all comprised of all the teacher, all the educational employees. There are no other state obligations related to any educational employees.
Mr. Chair and members, the only plan that I didn't actually give you the number for the unfunded liability is the legislator's plan. It's very small. It's 430 people. It was a pay-as-you-go plan, so it wasn't set up to be pre-funded like our other plans. So I can get to that number, what that currently is, but I don't have it with me today.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. And in comparison, I noticed that the FTAPs on all these plans, you know, are from 50 to 90%, most of them significantly below where we'd like to be at present date. But it seems that in the private sector, when you're building or setting up a plan, most of these actuarial assumptions, rates of return, are now built at or targeted around 5 or 6%. And we're still at 7.5%. And again, I said earlier, a promise made is a promise kept, but should we be modifying these plans so that new employees under state contracts should have a lesser expectation in terms of what the rate of return is? Should we be building that plan on an annualized rate at a different rate because we are also experiencing longer lifespans? And so to maintain this 7.5% assumption, which oftentimes goes back along with defined benefit plans rather than defined contribution plans, is a system that assumed that people didn't live as long. And I think you know, we should be looking at that very closely, because I see this as not being on track in 40 years if we don't continue to make improvements to shore this up, because it's going to be a big liability.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's a very good question, because there's a pretty significant distinction between how the actuarial work and the accounting work is done between the public sector and the private sector. So in the public sector, it is really typically a little more simple view of looking at what is the expected future return from the investments, and then measuring the liability in that fashion. The Government Accounting Standards Board has addressed this issue as well, and that's been an issue the last few years about whether that should be different. But there too, they're also relying on the long-term investment return, and as we'll see with our numbers, have seen the GASB results are the same as the funding results for our plan. So again, the public sector, it's very much long-term focused, because the assumption is that these entities, these employees, will be there in the long term. Public sector has changed a lot over 30 years, and I did work in that field for nearly 30 years. And 30 years ago, it was done very much the same way, measured on a long-term investment assumption, and that was it, and each employer was allowed to fund based on that presumption. The private sector, thank you. In the private sector, some of the accounting rules changed to be a little bit more in sync with the possibility that private employers may not be there indefinitely, that they may be sold to another private employer, and that shareholders want to understand with that potential what exactly is the liability that would be possible there. Or if a private employer is not going to survive or be able to afford that promise, follow through on that promise to those employees, they may have to turn over that liability to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or purchase annuities from a private employer, a private company, insurance company. So that led to a change in the way those liabilities were measured. It didn't change the employer's views of their investment returns. And if you look close enough in a lot of reporting, corporate reporting, they'll still show an investment return assumption, and to see 7 or 7.5 is not uncommon, but that's not how they're allowed to measure under the accounting standards. So under the accounting standards for private, they have to measure as if they may not be there, the company may not be there, overall. So that's a different. It's a difference in reporting. So it's not necessarily a difference in belief about the investment return. It's more reflecting a belief about whether the long-term standing of a public sector versus a private employer.
Representative Hertzhaus, one more question.
Thank you. And so your story reminds me of Minneapolis Moline and its failure and all of the folks that, you know, were out of a pension. And so I think what you just articulated is private sector does go out of business, but government has the power of levy.
And Representative Hertzhaus, that's the Minneapolis Moline and a few what they happened at that time brought us ERISA at the federal level, right, for private plans. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept of contributions, the sufficiency percentage, seems to be really important, and I'm not sure I really grasp the definition. Could you repeat the definition for how that's calculated?
Mr. Stoffel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, so the definition of contribution sufficiency, in real simple terms, it's a measure of whether we're going to hit the mark, the 30-year, we have 30 years to meet our unfunded obligation, and if it's positive, we are ahead of schedule. If it's negative, we're behind schedule. If it's zero, that, again, is it's right on. So to be, in our case, we're 0.21% positive. It's a very small number. It's positive, so we're happy about that. Some of the other measures are a little bit higher, mm-hmm, but in all cases we're positive. So essentially means we're projecting to be ahead of the 30-year schedule to be fully funded.
So positive is good.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah. Positive is good. Negative is bad. The bigger the positive, the better.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, correct. Zero. If it comes out to be a calculation of zero, you're right on. You're going to be fully funded in that 30-year period.
And members, a good way to look at that funding, the amortization schedule is look at it like your house mortgage. You take out a 30-year mortgage and you pay it off a little bit all the time. And the sufficiency means you may be paying more money in. Deficiency, you're not paying enough money in to pay that mortgage off. That's a good way to wrap your head around it.
And just a comment that I do draw a small pension from my Northwest Airlines days. The pension's been assumed by Delta Airlines now. And every year they send me a statement that tells me how badly underfunded it is. It's usually funded at about 50% of what it should be.
And Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is going to Mr. Anderson. In regards to the Volunteer Fire Fund, is that primarily funded through the Relief Association through the 2% fund, or is that various fundings coming in? Or?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it's primarily funded from the 2% fund. I think you're referring to the 2% from fire insurance premiums. Yes, it's primarily that. And most of those plans are fairly well funded. There's a handful that also have funding that would go back to the municipality, but that's a pretty small minority.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Anderson, thank you, Mr. Chair. And is that paid out at the same rate throughout the state to each member, or is that vary per department, or how is that done?
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it can vary from department to department. So the department can make an election on what that amount would be, and they, from time to time, can seek to change that amount if they can see the actuarial impact of that. But that's a choice that they can make. It can vary.
One last question, Mr. Chair, please. And Mr. Anderson, this is an optional program to these relief associations. It's not mandated by the state that they have to belong to these or to with everybody else.
Representative, I'm not entirely sure. It's an option for a department to join the statewide volunteer fire department. So there are around 700 departments overall throughout the state, of which 158 or so have opted to join the para statewide volunteer fire department. But I can't speak to the origination of those 700 departments and whether that's an option or not.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a better question for the State Board of Investment, but I'm curious as to how investment decisions are made and whether it is purely a rate of return that is considered, or if it is also considered things like ethical or socially responsible screens, or if there are considerations made to investment in Minnesota and the, you know, returns that those would bring to our communities.
Ms. Leonard.
Mr. Chair, members, so the State Board of Investment has adopted investment beliefs. They're available on their website. They do have a specific belief around ESG environment, ESG investing. I can't speak to it in detail. The way that they're governed, the State Board is the constitutional officers. They have a staff. Mansco Perry is the executive director. And then there's also an investment advisory council that includes investment professionals around the state who come in. We meet, the three of us sit on that, and we meet quarterly. And so a lot of the decisions that are made or approved by the State Board are at the recommendation and approval of the IAC. So it's a fairly well-vetted process. But if you're interested in the specific guidelines, the beliefs are a great tool in plain language as to what they look at when they're looking at those investments.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the ESG guidelines, do those include local investments? Does that include looking at the possibility that if you invest in Minnesota, you can have returns outside of the typical stock market rate of return?
Ms. Leonard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, I don't believe, I'm going off memory, I don't believe Minnesota specifically mentioned. They do look at overall investments, but I know that there are some Minnesota investments. So I don't believe the beliefs specifically state anything about Minnesota.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to any of the testifiers, I guess, is in the presentation and the 81% funded ratio, are we assuming in all of those presentations and that the 7.5% rate of return that's statutory?
Mr. Stoffel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, yes, 7.5% for all the funds.
And
Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it goes back to some of the questions that are being asked here because, you know, and I've brought this up. And by the way, I had the opportunity to serve on the Pension Commission last year, and I applaud the efforts here. This was no small task, and it's certainly a nerdy thing, even though it gets my heart palpitating, not everybody's. to see the amount of work and the amount of conversation that had to happen to make this work was really a great effort, and I think reflected in that unanimous vote. So I appreciate what we have done. I guess my concern is going forward, we saved our rating from my perspective for last year. My concern now is that going forward, we're still in what I would consider to be, as a financial person, a crisis mode. And the reason I say that and the reason I asked about those projections is we're at 7.5%. And Mr. Perry was here a few weeks ago and was asked about the socially conscious investments and so forth. And one of his comments was, I'm serving two masters. I'm trying to serve that, but I also realize I have to make the nut. I got to get 7.5% because that's what's being presented here. 7.5% in today's environment is not easy to do in a relatively low risk portfolio. And I've looked at this in other states. A lot of them are looking at even 6.5, 6.75%. My reason for bringing that up is if you look at it and you add up all of the pension assets, about $70 billion, correct?
And they're shaking their heads, yes.
Okay. If we miss by 1%, and indeed only do 6.5% rather than 7%, or 7.5%. That's almost $700 million a year. That doesn't come in investment income that has to be made up. So my question is there still a concern that we have work to do? And if we have work to do, would it be mainly around that investment return? Because I do believe that the actuarial determinations on liabilities are probably correct. But if we miss it on the assets, we could have a huge problem, maybe even in the vicinity of $750 million a year to make up in the investment return if we can't hit that 7.5% nut.
And, yeah, before you answer, we're going to have the SBI, State Board of Investments, here next week. So some of those questions might be better answered by them. But if somebody wants to tackle it here, we can Ms. Leonard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I think when we're thinking, you know, investment returns are going to fluctuate each year. They're going to be up, they're going to be down. Fortunately, the last 2 years we've been up significantly over the 7.5%. And so it's, and we look long term. We're looking long term for these programs. So we're looking at the best, we're trying to project the best assumption we can based on the investments that we have and the investment markets that are in the future. The answer last year was 7.5. Could that change? Perhaps. We spoke to the caution around the sufficiency where people think, oh, well, you're overfunding these plans. We can't look at them on a year-to-year basis. We really do need to look at the long term. And so, yes, in 1 year we may be down, and this year might be that year. But in the future we might be up as well. And the SBI does a great job of a very disciplined approach to reallocating their investments. So when we're down, we might even still benefit from future earnings because they're reallocating their investments. So, yes, it's something we need to be aware of. It's something we watch carefully. It's something our actuaries point out. They give us a reasonable range in our reports. It's definitely become a lot of conversation around the country. So your point is valid, although we're really trying to look at the long term.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor it. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that yeah. We're almost that we may not be done here. And just comment relative to the deficiency. From a financial person's perspective, I would look at that as a deficiency on the mortgage that we had on the previous house that we're paying back, as well as the mortgage that we're now incurring with the current employees. So we're actually paying two mortgages now. The current one, but the deficiency also over 30 years for things that should have been done before. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. Mr. Stoffel?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make one comment. I think Aaron gave a fine answer, but in response to something I did hear about being done for pensions, we're never done. We use a phrase around our board table. We try to avoid the word fix or done. It's what we do is we monitor and we adjust, and I think we have, as was stated earlier, that Minnesota has a very good history of adjusting along the way, and it's a responsible legislature. We have responsible boards. The 7.5% was a huge change, and what I think I would like to argue is that let's let it work. Let's let the whole plan. These contribution rates are phasing in over 5 or 6 years. Benefits are being reduced. Those are being phased in. So there's a lot of moving parts here. Let's let the plan work for a time. We need to revisit whether 7.5 is right or not. But it's never done. It's not fixed. It's always monitor and adjust. We'll be back someday, hopefully with good news, maybe with not such good news, but it's pensions are never done.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. So, Mr. Anderson, just a quick question. I'm neglecting to remind myself in terms of the graph of the Excel spreadsheet that we all looked at with very, very specific eyes at the close of last biennium. But how much will the state save per year based upon the changes in the Pension Reform Act of 2018?
They're all kind of Mr. Anderson.
Yeah,
it's a big number.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I'm very familiar with the spreadsheet, but I think of it more in terms of the numbers that we presented on page 7, the aggregate numbers about total savings, which was $6.1 billion when measuring all the savings and how much of that was past service and how much was future service. What I don't have committed to memory was the annual savings amount, so I'd have to revisit that spreadsheet, which I should carry with me, but don't. But I have to look at that to get you the exact number.
That's fine. Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Representative Albright.
I too served on that committee, and it was a two-year journey to complete the task at hand. I share all of the concerns that are both representatives Hertas and Hurt Vogel have articulated. That being said, should we anticipate that this dais would be coming back to this committee or the pension committee, the commission itself this year, possibly asking for an adjustment in the funding stream?
And that kind of hits my last question I was going to say for the end. Is there any pressing needs that we need to be aware of?
with the Pension Commission and coming forward. So I guess that's thinking the same way.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if the question is for this year, TRA has not even an administrative bill this year. We're not looking at any funding changes this year. I don't anticipate any for a while, I hope. But again, we're going to monitor and adjust. But we have nothing coming before you this year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just, I think a couple of things that shouldn't be overlooked in the overall, and I just want to make sure that people are reminded that the pension commission, and really there are obligations that we contractually sign on to for the benefit of a number of groups and the people, is looked upon by the bond houses in very, very great detail in terms of when we go out to let our general obligation bonds and whatnot. And when they start asking questions about your obligations to your pension plans, and they become even more a substantial portion of the conversation, you know that we've got some work to do. And as I've talked with folks from previous career life about the rating and the bond houses looking at the state of Minnesota and their bond rating, we actually were improved on our bond rating, and in no small part was that decision made based upon the intent but also the completion of the task with the 2018 pension reform bill. So I think that it's a sleeper decision that we made that affects in a collateral benefit a number of other categories that our budgets have to deal with. So I just want to make that note, and I appreciate all the work that both you individually and your staffs as well as your organizations made on behalf of the Pension Commission the last 2 years. It really was a very bipartisan effort that everyone contributed to.
And I'll have to echo that the Pension Commission, I was put back on it last year at the end of session, but they did a lot of hard work the last 2 years, and you guys have helped with that and your members helped with that. So I want to thank you for that also. And any closing statements? Otherwise, thank you for being in the committee and giving us the information and educating us on part of our budget that we're going to have to look at. And if there are no further questions or comments, we are Thursday we're going to have the State Board of Investments here and the Legislative Commission on Pensions. So we didn't get to that today. So with that, members, we are adjourned.